I had a reflection on the journey to Emmaus sent to me by someone in the church. It was from another United Church. It was sent out as, I think, just an email. And they gave me permission to share this with you, and to kind of, they knew, know where I'm going to go with this. But just in case you've forgotten, the journey to Emmaus is the main story at the very end of the Gospel of Luke after Jesus has been raised from the dead. And in that story, which I think is like almost 30 verses long, Luke tells about two disciples who are leaving Jerusalem on Easter morning and who journey on their way back to their hometown of Emmaus, about 12 kilometers away, and along the way, Jesus comes to them. But they can't see him. And it's only at the end of the story that, that Paul read that they finally awaken to the presence of Jesus with them. And I just want to read you this reflection since we've been thinking about this story for the last 4 weeks. This is our fourth week with the journey to Emmaus. And this is what this person says. Something to think about. Today's verse is from the story of the road to Emmaus. No one knows where Emmaus was. In the whole Bible, this is the only place where Emmaus is mentioned. Marcus Borg says that Emmaus is nowhere because Emmaus is everywhere. Emmaus is wherever your journey leads you to feel despair, to doubt, to question the meaning of life. Emmaus is where you question God, those around you even question yourself. Emmaus is when you are grieving deeply and you doubt you will feel happy again. Emmaus is when you watch a spouse or parent diminish with each passing week. Emmaus is when you're tired and bored and you wonder if there's any more to life than this. The road to Emmaus is an ordinary road, a road we find ourselves on quite a bit. It's the road where our lives feel as though they are going nowhere in particular. They're just going. And on that road, on our road, Jesus comes near and goes with us. Jesus is with us on the road to nowhere. I really like that idea. And I there's a lot about the reflection I appreciate. It's got a nice thought to it, a nice feel to it. Like we're all walking on the road to Emmaus. We pray that we can find Jesus along the way, no matter where we are headed or what circumstances we find ourselves in. And yet I have a problem with this reflection. I want to tell you about it. And I see this kind of approach taken a lot in the United Church. We take a Bible story, and we turn it into a metaphor for life. Emmaus isn't a real place. Emmaus stands for all the places that we find ourselves in. And the journey to Emmaus in Luke is not a real journey of real people struggling with a real problem at a specific time. Rather, it's a symbolic journey that we all make, especially when we find life hard or when we find ourselves in times of real despair or are confronted with real challenges. So our experiences get to be real, our challenges get to be real, but what Luke is writing about is only a story. And we're not to take it seriously on its own account, but only by what it can mean for us today. I remember attending a special service many years ago. A United Church minister was preaching about Jesus turning water into wine in Cana of Galilee. You might know that story in the Gospel of John. And the preacher made the same kind of interpretive mood that I noticed in this reflection. Jesus didn't really turn water into wine. Rather, the story is a metaphor about how God can turn the mundane realities of our own lives into something special, turn our water into wine. And of course, God can turn the mundane realities of your life and my life into something special. God can turn the heartache of the moment into a life of joy, water into wine. I imagine most of us here would agree with that, but why do we think this is so? I went up to the preacher afterwards and asked her, if Jesus didn't turn real water into real wine, why would I believe that God could do something real in my own life? My circumstances are real. My challenges in life are real. My situations in life are real. Why would I trust a story that within itself is about something that is not real? If Jesus didn't turn water into wine in Cana of Galilee, if it wasn't a real event, why would I have any confidence that God can turn the water of my real life circumstances into wine? See, the stories that move me, and I suspect you too, are stories about real things, real healing, real overcoming, real victories, real endurance, real learning. Now, stories can be symbolic. No one doubts that, I don't think. There's definitely a typology at play in stories, that there's a basic pattern of life in our stories. And I believe God can turn my hard circumstances into blessings. And I believe God can turn your hard circumstances into blessings too. But I believe this because I believe long ago Jesus turned water into wine. You see, for an analogy to work, there has to be something real about both sides of the analogy. Why would we think that we might really find Jesus on the road we are walking today if two disciples back 2,000 years ago did not really meet Jesus as they journeyed to Emmaus? I see this problem a lot in our church and in mainline churches generally. We don't want to take the Bible story seriously. We take our own circumstances seriously, but we don't take the biblical story seriously. We don't meet them on their own terms. Luke did not write the story about the journey to Emmaus as a metaphor for us. That we can use it this way is fine. That it can be a metaphor is fine, but he didn't write it that way. Luke was a historian and a biographer. He was writing a historical biography about Jesus. And it's true that we don't know which of the villages around Jerusalem was actually Emmaus. But the fact that we don't know the name of the village, we do know the name, but we don't know where that village of Emmaus it was actually located, doesn't mean that Luke didn't know. Luke wrote his gospel long, long time ago, very close to the events that he's narrating. We know there was a battle between Hannibal and the Carthaginians and Scipio and the Romans in North Africa in 202 BC at a place called Zama. But we cannot identify the exact location of the battle. We don't know exactly where it took place. Was it this ground over here? Or was it that ground over there? We don't know. But no historian of the ancient world doubts that the battle actually took place. It most certainly did. There was a real place called Zama where a battle between the Carthaginians and Romans took place, even if we cannot identify exactly where Zama is. Luke says at the opening of his gospel this, and Dave, I got a slide for you up there. He says this, right at the beginning of his gospel, he says, many have undertaken to draw up an account of the things that have been fulfilled among us, just as they were handed down to us by those who from the first were eyewitnesses and servants of the word. With this in mind, since I myself have carefully investigated everything from the beginning, I too decided to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus. And why did Luke write this gospel? This is what he says the next verse over. So that you may know the certainty of the things you have been taught. Luke says he carefully investigated everything from the beginning. He wants to make an accurate account of the events of the life and ministry of Jesus. And I'm not a fundamentalist. I will acknowledge to you that perhaps Luke made mistakes in his writing. Somewhere along the way, he might have made a mistake. Who knows? My approach is to give him the benefit of the doubt. Until I know otherwise, I personally give him the benefit of the doubt. And I don't need the Gospels to be perfect in order to trust them. The question for me is whether they're reliable, sufficient for salvation. I can tell you one thing that I'm very confident about. I can tell you that Luke did not set out to what he did not set out to do for us. He did not intend to pass on to us stories that he knew were factually incorrect. He did not put the story of the journey to Emmaus into his gospel primarily as a metaphor for our own spiritual journey in life. That's kind of ridiculous when you think about it. That we can use his story this way is fine. That we can use the story of the journey to Emmaus in the Gospel of Luke in this way is fine. But in truth, it's really about a story of two disciples walking home from Jerusalem to Emmaus in the defeat that came out of Jesus' crucifixion on a cross. and who shockingly meet him unknowingly raised from the dead. That's what the story is about. The story of the journey to Emmaus is not principally about you or me. It's not about your journey in life or my journey in life. It's about the earliest church coming to know the risen Lord. It's a story about two disciples coming to see that Jesus was truly raised from death to life. The person who wrote the reflection mentioned that Marcus Borg said that Emmaus is nowhere because Emmaus is everywhere. Understand that Marcus Borg doesn't believe in the real, tangible resurrection of Jesus. He therefore has no choice but to make this story into some kind of metaphor. But I believe that Jesus really truly was raised from the dead in a tangible, recognizable way, in a bodily sort of way, so I don't need to bend this story like a pretzel into a metaphor. Here's the thing. Luke believed, after careful scrutiny of the data, that Jesus was tangibly and recognizably raised from the dead. He believed in a bodily resurrection of sorts, and not just Luke, the whole earliest church believed this, that Jesus was raised tangibly from the dead. This is the basic message that they took out into the world. And it goes right back to the beginning. It wasn't something they came across decades or centuries later. We can tease this story right back to the very beginning of the founding of the church, only moments after Jesus' death. Where did they get this idea from? Do you remember last week we were talking about deductive reasoning, deductive logic? How deductive reasoning works? You have a few premises. And if the premises are correct, then the conclusion must be correct. I use the example of fruit. I think I have that up there for you there. There's an example of the deduction there, Dave. Okay, just there's one on fruits. Okay, sorry. This should be, okay, there we are. It's all that work for a simple argument, right? So the deductive argument on fruit. All fruit have seeds. Apples are a type of fruit. So premise one is all fruits have seeds. Premise two, apples are a type of fruit. If those two premises are correct, then the conclusion must be apples have, well, we got a philosopher here. Am I right about that? Yes, okay. Not wrong, that's right, okay. That's a good philosophical response. Yeah. It's a pretty straightforward way of reasoning, and we use it all the time. We use it all the time in life. One common one that's used is the next one, Dave, on Greek men. You see this quite a bit in the literature. Ancient Greek men wore beards, that's premise one. Premise two, Socrates was an ancient Greek man, therefore the conclusion must be Socrates must have worn a beard, right? And I was mentioning to you that the two disciples last week were working from a simple deductive argument when it came to Jesus. And I've got that one up there too. There's a deductive argument on Messiah. Premise one, Messiah cannot die. Premise two, Jesus is dead. Therefore, the conclusion must be Jesus cannot be the Messiah, right? Case closed in their minds. And the only way to defeat a deductive argument is by proving that one or more of the premises are incorrect. And when you think about the premises, they are vulnerable in a way that we often don't recognize. For instance, how do we know that all fruits have seeds? Like, how do we know that? Where did that idea come from? We didn't deduce it. It actually is inductively arrived at. And by that, I mean we use our common everyday experience to arrive at this conclusion. We looked at all kinds of fruits. We looked at oranges and kiwis, plums, bananas, apricots. What do they all have? Seeds. And then we looked at peaches and pears, blackberries, cherries, melons, cantaloupe. What do they all have too? Seeds. Actually, they do. That's genetically modified, right? We've removed them, right? Grapes, lemons, limes, strawberries, raspberries, every fruit that we've discovered over time has seeds, right? So at some point, we can make a reasonable inference. We can say that all types of fruit have seeds, but it's not an 100% guaranteed argument. Maybe we just haven't discovered the one fruit somewhere in some deep, dark forest that is a fruit that has no seeds, that propagates itself in some other way. Maybe there's some kind of fruit out there that would disprove this premise. How do we know that all ancient Greek men wore beards? Well, every statue and every painting that we've run across of ancient Greek men show them wearing beards. But maybe there's some important information missing. Maybe Socrates is the one in a million guy in the ancient world who didn't wear a beard. Or maybe only men with beard get statues made of them or have their faces painted on pottery. Who knows, right? All through the Middle Ages, philosophers used swans in their deductive examples. I didn't put it up there, but it's a simple one. All swans are white birds. You see a swan, what color of bird are you looking at? What color of bird are you looking at? White, right? You're looking at a white bird. No, I don't want that. You see, I knew you were going to do that to me. Simple. But remember, premises are built on induction. Premise that all swans are white was built on induction based on people's common experience. Europeans had only ever seen white swans. They talked to people from around the world as they expanded outwards. People had only ever seen white swans. People came to believe that swans were white. All white swans were white. And then some explorer in Australia discovered, a black swan. And that destroyed the premise. And this is where we get the idea of black swan events. Have you heard about that? Events that cut against common experience, they're called black swan events. Events that run against our common notions. Events that go beyond our ability to accurately predict. Events and realities that run against our basic deductive premises. They're called black swan events. Last Sunday, we looked at how Jesus challenged the first premise of the two disciples' deductive argument. Now you can throw that up there, Dave, again. He challenged Messiah cannot die. Jesus did a detailed explanation of the scriptures as the disciples and him walked to Emmaus. He talked to them, explained to them in deep discussion about the significance of the scriptures when it came down to whether Messiah could die. In fact, Luke records it this way, and Jesus starts speaking. He says, "Did not the Messiah have to suffer these things and then enter into his glory?" And then beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he explained to them what was said in all the scriptures concerning himself. And you sense in the story that the disciples' deductive argument is starting to crack. Something is shifting for them because premise one, Messiah cannot die, is starting to break down. Maybe it's true that Messiah can die. Maybe Jesus doesn't get canceled out because he died. That's an interesting idea. Jesus' death doesn't cancel him out. And as premise one is starting to fray, the three of them arrive in Emmaus. And it looks like Jesus is going to keep going on his way, but the two disciples ask him to come into their home and to share a meal with them and perhaps stay the night with them. And at the meal, the stranger takes charge and he takes bread and he breaks it and he begins to give it to them. What does that remind you of? What story in the Bible does this breaking of bread and giving it to the disciples remind you of? Anyone want to guess? The Last Supper, yeah. Only a few days ago, actually, in the story that's being told to us, because remember, we're still on Easter Day in the Gospel of Luke. Only 3 days earlier, 4 days, depending how you count it, there's Jesus having his Last Supper with the disciples, and he takes bread, he breaks it, gives thanks, breaks it, and gives it to his disciples. And in that familiar moment with them, the disciples see. Their eyes are open, and they recognize him. And in that moment, he disappears because mission is accomplished. Premise one is scuppered. It turns out that the Messiah can die, maybe even must die. Premise two is now completely shattered as well. Jesus is alive. He was dead, but now he's alive. The evidence that they were walking with Jesus as they journeyed to Emmaus was always there to be had. They could have seen him, but they were mesmerized by their deductive logic, as we often are. Messiah cannot die. Jesus is dead. Therefore, he can't be here with us. Even though their hearts were burning, even though as they walked and talked with him and he opened up the scriptures to them, they could sense something powerful moving. Were not our hearts burning within us while he talked with us on the road and opened the scriptures to us? It turns out we have new premises taking shape around Messiah. They are the following. Messiah can die. Jesus is alive. What is the conclusion then? What is the right conclusion? The two disciples immediately get back on the road. We don't know how late it was, but they get back on the road. They're on the road again, right? And they're now moving in the opposite direction. They're going back to Jerusalem, and they're moving probably at a lot faster clip. And when they get back to Jerusalem and they find the 11, they find that the 11 are in a state of commotion as well, because they have also discovered that Jesus has risen. The Lord is alive. He's come to Peter. And now Cleopas and his companion are retelling their own experience about how they too saw the Lord as he broke bread with them. This confirmation that Jesus is alive is going to happen again and again and again to many disciples. In fact, Paul says 500 disciples at one time saw Jesus raised from the dead, alive again. Many were still alive when Paul wrote this, that had witnessed that experience. The story of the journey to Emmaus is principally about how the earliest church came to believe that Jesus is alive. That's what the story's about. It's about how one set of beliefs were replaced by another set of beliefs. Emmaus is not about us, as tempting as it is to make it so. Emmaus is about Jesus and his first disciples. It's one of many stories in the Gospels about how the earliest church comes to believe and celebrate that Jesus is alive. And if we believe that the Lord is to be found in our own walk in life, when our journey leads to despair or doubt, or when we are grieving deeply, or when we are exhausted by life, if we believe Jesus can be found in those times and places in our own journey, it is because long ago, real disciples met a real Jesus raised from the dead as they journeyed to a real place called Emmaus. And in fact, the story of Emmaus is even more remarkable than that. In truth, we don't find Jesus along the way in life. Wherever we're going, he finds us. And if we keep our hearts open and we allow our premises to be challenged and even replaced, we will come to know his presence and his fellowship, because Jesus is alive. And he comes to wherever he finds his disciples.